Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. In this extended episode, published to coincide with a festival celebrating London becoming a national park city, I talk to Dan Raven Ellison, the campaigner behind the initiative. Dan is far more than just a one-trick pony, having spent a lifetime seeking ways of getting people young and old outdoors and into nature. He's also been exploring new ways of making it easier for people to understand the scale of increasing urbanisation and its impact on the natural world, of which we're all part. A self-styled guerrilla geographer, our conversation begins with Dan explaining what that means. Tell me what guerrilla geography is all about. Have you ever studied geography?
So guerrilla geography is radical, alternative, creative, maybe surprising geographies. Guerrilla geography is about exploring places and thinking differently about places, but also doing things that encourage people to think differently about those places, or even taking actions that actually change those places in maybe a like really creative or interesting way. So people often think maybe in terms of guerrilla art, in terms of street art, like artists like Banksy, who, if you look at his artwork, quite often his approach is about taking something out of place that gets you to think differently about a particular scenario or location. So swapping a grenade with some flowers out of someone's hand or something like that. Or you think of guerrilla gardeners who intentionally plant different things in places to make that place better or get you thinking different about that place. So for me, those two practices are almost within the toolkit of what guerrilla geography is about. But guerrilla geography actually can work at any number of scales, going from right down to someone's palm of their hand, right up to the scale of a city or even the planet.
The little bit you didn't answer was, have you ever studied geography?
I think we are all studying geography all the time, aren't we? You're in the womb and then you're given birth and you're into the world, like you're getting a sense of place and you're thinking about the world and how you relate to it. I think that people consciously think about the fact that they're doing science often. They're doing an experiment. I'm doing science. I'm going to a science museum. I'm doing science. Or they maybe realise consciously they're doing history because they're visiting a castle or, you know, whatever it might be. I think with geography, it's always there in everything we do when we're sort of navigating the world. And although we are all talented geographers in our own ways, in our own lives, we're not necessarily as conscious about it as we are maybe other fields of thought. But yeah, I mean, I loved doing my GCSEs in geography and then my A-levels in geography. And then I did a degree in geography. Then I became a high school geography teacher. There was the joy and frustration of being a high school geography teacher that led me towards this practice of guerrilla geography.
But you and I met, I was trying to work it out, I think we met about 2009, 2010, I'm not sure. It was at a time when you were involved in something called the Geography Collective, and the output of that was something called Mission Explore.
Right.
What is Mission Explore?
Mission Explore was really a response to two things. There was a group of us who set up a group called the Geography Collective, and we were a collective of geography artists, therapists, teachers, academics, activists, who essentially wanted to maybe raise some public consciousness about the importance of geography by doing some guerrilla geography acts, things like holding international waterboarding championships outside the US Embassy in central London, where there was a sign saying no ball games, where apparently it was completely fine for us to put on netball vests and waterboard each other for as long as possible before, you know, we couldn't cope. That was completely fine, but having a kick around was completely wrong. And it was just about, a bit like when I mentioned Banksy earlier, it was about, through a physical practice, taking what we were doing that's normally thought of in terms of a practice which is done in a private and secret space, putting it into a public space and just saying, you know, what do you think about this? Then we sort of evolved into doing some other kinds of things and really wanted to tackle this issue of how can we inspire more young people to be excited by geography, maybe some of the geographies that they wouldn't come across in the classroom, while also tackling this issue of the fact that, geographically speaking, children's right to roam and freedom to play has been shrinking, you know, generation by generation. This has been well, you know, documented. And actually, I think we were partially inspired, believe it or not, by the Daily Mail, where there was this fantastic map showing three generations of children's freedom to explore and roam and play in the Sheffield area. And you can see the sort of grandfather going out miles away from Sheffield Centre on sort of big hikes and getting into all sorts of intrepid adventures. And then the parents getting just to the local neighbourhood, and then their children only really being given their bedroom and maybe a bit of their garden to go and play in. So Mission Explore, inspired also by psychogeography, and how within psychogeography it's so playful, so creative, so engaging, but it's also so cerebral and it's so inaccessible to most people. If you think about it, when you're like 5, 6, 7, when you're in deep play, basically you're a psychogeographer, imagining you're in one place doing something in another place while being something that normally would happen in another place. So we wanted to play on these different things. Geography is awesome. Let's get more children playing outside and let's use psychogeography. Actually, I think learning as well and being inspired by people like Duncan Fuller, the late geographer, who had My Walks project, which was all about exploring the world and asking questions, provocative questions, so you think differently about it. And also Rights and Sites, who did some brilliant work around things like the Misguides to Anywhere and the Misguides to Exeter, which were actually more accessible forms of psychogeography, I think. So we created, firstly, a series of children's books, and then a website and an app, and went to music festivals and things, with these different provocations that children could explore. Things like investigating the murder of an animal, which is quite an interesting philosophical question. Firstly, you need to go and find a dead animal. But then there's an interesting question within that about, you know, well, can you murder an animal? And what is an animal? And what is murder? And actually, what kind of skills do you need to have to be able to investigate that particular question? To get lost somewhere you can't get lost. To cross a park like this one from one side to the other without being seen by a single squirrel. We had another one which I quite liked, which we got Doreen Massey, the late geographer, to do for us, which was to ask a bunch of old people to dress up in hoodies and to hang out on a street corner and see how people would react to them. So, you know, playing on these issues of environmental, social, animal, injustice often, but often also just in purely playful things.
So that was great. That was getting what young people really involved, or just as many, you know, when I say young, it was young kids, but was it actually adults as well?
Yeah, it was lots of adults as well.
And lots of adults
wanting to find their inner child. I think a lot of us want to be playful. A lot of us want to play hide and seek, but we need to be round up or, you know, convinced to do so,
You've actually done some pretty mammoth walks, and I'd like to know why. Okay, let's start with why have you done these mammoth walks? What's in your mind or in your soul that says you've got to go out and do some walk?
I think I get a lot from long walks, emotionally and personally. I think I see walks and growing stuff, you know, as political assertions and ways to encourage myself and other people to think about the world. I mean, for me, exploration is the physical manifestation of geography, really. Back in 2008, when a lot of my most recent work journey sort of began, more people started living in urban than rural places for the first time. And that inspired me to think about the children that I was teaching and the students I was teaching at the time and teaching high school geography, so 11-year-olds right up to 18-year-olds. I was really aware that the sense of place that they had of cities was really distorted because the images that the media reveal to us are often images of extremes. So it might be sort of slums in Mumbai, or you see the city of London in London. And these often sort of twist these places in our imagination, so we don't really have a proper sense of what they're like or a proper sense of proportion. So I decided to do a project to walk across some of the world's largest cities, taking a photograph every 8 steps. But what I wanted to do, and I think there's something sort of deep inside me in terms of a sense of the need to have a better understanding and representation of places and what that means from an inequality and justice perspective, maybe, where the walks would be designed so the length of the walk would represent the size of the footprint of the city, but the route itself would also reflect the distribution of multiple deprivation within that urban area as well. So if the poorest fifth of people occupy just 1% of the city's urban footprint, then only 1% of my walk would go through that kind of area. And so I would sort of map these quite complicated routes going through cities, which would not really be designed by me. They'd be designed by the city largely, because actually it's quite hard to get from one side of the city to the other when you've only got a certain number of percentage points passing through it. And that was important because you think of a city like London, and actually if you were to walk south to North London, just slightly east of the City of London, compared to just west of the City of London, you'd have a very different experience of what London looks like. You know, it's very, very different boroughs. And so for me, just the idea of a random transect like that, even over 60 kilometres, wasn't satisfactory enough. And so then I made these films, taking a photograph of 8 steps. They have been used and inspired geography teachers and students in sort of countries around the world, I think, which is really cool. One of my favourite things is that they were used at Glastonbury Festival a few years ago. So there's loads of people raving in the dance village, watching themselves sort of zoom through Mexico or Mumbai or whatever, which I really liked.
So which cities did you walk through?
Well, for that project then, it was Mexico City, Mumbai, London. And then I started picking up other cities, so places like Portland in the United States, Manchester at night starting as the sun was just setting and the finishing just as sort of dawn came.
Well, you put yourself through a lot of discipline. I mean, you know, not only do you have to try and work out the route that you take, but then you're taking a photograph every eight, what did you say?
Every eight steps. So you've got thousands of photographs within these experimental films, so you can sort of zoom in a time lapse through the city.
What did you encounter which was unexpected?
Well, I think that it's really interesting how, you know, in terms of this idea of guerrilla geography, some things which are very guerrilla in one place may not be guerrilla in another place. And actually, for a lot of places around the world, just the act of walking is like an activist pursuit. It's a, you know, really guerrilla activity. I mean, yeah, you only have to think actually in the UK about the activity of tree climbing now. I mean, it's fairly subversive for kids to try and climb a tree in many places. Rope swings, you know, they're really subversive in some places. In Mexico City, a lot of the city, you know, it's not designed for walking. People don't expect you to be walking. The walk in Mexico City revealed to me in some ways is the way that the neglect that some planners have for some people who use the city. So there's this one place where we're walking across a really busy intersection into like traffic island. And in the middle of the traffic island, there's a whole load of metal play equipment. And my friend Etienne, who's sort of walking with me, stands up on a slide to take this photograph, and he gets this massive electrocution. And there's some power lines right nearby that were constantly charging, apparently, like this metal play equipment. So all these Mexican kids who had to cross this busy road to play in this area all laughed at him because they obviously knew that you don't play on the metal play equipment, otherwise, you know, you get electrocuted. And it's almost like someone has decided not only to put a whole load of play equipment in the middle of a really dangerous place to get to. Another reflection from Mexico City for me, though, was that a lot of explorers and adventurers come back with stories, and clearly all kinds of things happened on this walk, right? And I could share all kinds of things that did happen, but also like a lot didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a story that I quite like to share is that there's this one moment towards the end of the walk when we're about to go up to Santa Fe, which is an area where you've got a lot of informal, very poor housing next door to some of the highest property prices in the city. And a lot of people will get from one place to the other by car or helicopter, and there's no real footpath to get there. But just approaching that place, there was a group of women who came up to us and sort of said, you know, do you know what, don't walk down this alleyway. If you walk down this alleyway, then you're going to lose your clothes and you could lose your life, okay? And this is a brilliant non-story, because we spent 3 days walking across Mexico City and only met friendly people, and people were interested in what we were doing, but, like, unless I was completely ignorant, we didn't really face any threat, like, anywhere along the way. And the only place where we might have faced some threat, we didn't. We met a group of women who were saying, walk somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Which is just such a beautiful story to come away with, you know? Because actually what you hear from Mexico City all the time is kidnappings and murders, and clearly all that stuff does happen. But actually you can go on these urban adventures, go on these urban walks in quite a political way, and actually nothing happens. There's an awful lot of uneventfulness, and there's something quite nice about that.
Having crossed these cities, what came next?
I think that I was really aware that actually not everyone wants to sit around on Google Earth and finding all the data and working with academics to map out the complexities of the city and like a good route across it. And I wanted to think of a practice that I could do that other people could replicate, which was just far easier to engage with. So I developed this idea of urban story walks, where essentially, I largely put my camera down in terms of that systematic approach so that I could invite people on the walks with me so we could have conversations. You know, when people think of geographers, they often think of geographers exploring the height and shape of the physical landscape. Instead, what I started to do is look at the height, shape of social, economic, environmental factors in the landscape. And I'd go on walks down ridges of violence or through valleys of depression, or go on a polar exploration, which instead of going to like the Arctic or the poles, would explore the place which was most happy to least happy, this kind of thing. And by going on a walk with people with these maps, being able to look at the maps of these social factors and navigating that way, it became an opportunity to have a conversation mm-hmm. about those particular yep. themes and issues, and about the degree to which the issues were affecting the landscape and our experience of people in the landscape versus the landscape actually talking to us through those issues. So a really good example is, you know, you look at issue of happiness and well-being within parts of London where green spaces are completely fenced off, where there's several locks on everyone's front doors. And, you know, well, what are the range of issues that mean that in that particular mm-hmm. place people are reacting like that because of issues around their well-being, but then how actually the very armouring of those spaces equally then leads to a deterioration of people's well-being as well. And so, you know, I don't think we ever thought we necessarily came up with definitive answers and policy solutions, but it was just a really provocative and interesting way to explore those places.
You've not just done urban walking, you've also walked long distances through national parks. So it's the 70th anniversary of national parks.
It is indeed.
What was the purpose of that?
So I was doing a project with National Geographic and Cisco, exploring the relationship between technology, things, nature, city, people, and how by combining all those things we might be able to improve life for people and wildlife in different environments. So what I decided to do was do a project to walk across all the national parks and all the cities in the UK. It was about a 1,500 kilometre walk, about half my time in cities, half my time in national parks. And on my head, I was wearing an EEG.
What are you wearing on your head?
So I'm wearing an EEG, which is a special mind-reading device, which is able to read the different levels of electrical currents happening within my brain. And depending on where those currents are happening in my brain, it is able to infer my levels of excitement, relaxation, focus. The headset that I was wearing was definitely very prosumer. It wasn't like the best. And, you know, there's a bit of trust going in terms of the algorithms, and the sample size was just me. So there's lots of limitations to this. But essentially what I was doing was collecting millions of points of data as I walked these 1,600 kilometres. And I was able to map how my brain reacted to different kinds of environments during this journey.
You're an adventurer, obviously, but are you an endurance walker? How many kilometres were you walking a day?
Yes, I generally have a rule in my walking that I try not to walk more than 40 kilometres in a day on any two consecutive days, and I like to walk no more than 20 kilometres in a day. On the whole, my feet stop working after walking 40 kilometres a day for more than 3 days.
That's a long way.
So I did this project over 6 months. I, you know, went home every sort of couple of days. I was sort of a commuting explorer. Like, it wasn't about me being away for 6 months continually yeah. doing this project. But what this sort of headset revealed to me was that it was particularly deciduous woodland where I personally was most excited and most relaxed, and far more so deciduous woodland in cities than in national parks. So even if I went into a small area of woodland in a city, there'd be far, far more excitement and relaxation for me within that space, which is probably something to do with moving from the relativeness of a suburban car, you know, fueled environment or an industrial estate into the beauty of the dappled light and the curved branches and the birdsong of being within a wood environment. But I think maybe that says something about how important these spaces are for people in cities. And actually, if you're a 1-2-year-old with the neurons forming inside your brain at that sort of critical time, you don't necessarily need big nature or lots of trees to get benefit. A single oak tree is probably going to give you a fair amount. But potentially, the data could be used to inform people about walks they could take, which are more relaxing, that are more stressful if they want that, more exciting, more interesting, because other people have had those emotions in those places. Or if you flip that, thinking about how people design cities. So if, for example, on a subconscious level, without having to go and see like an expert, people can start to say, well, actually, I'm really stressed in this part of the city. Then whether it's about crime or traffic or there's something else going on, I think it could raise questions about the social and environmental justice and how that plays out in different geographies across the city in a way that could highlight to planners and to politicians that something needs to happen in this particular place. But on the other side as well, like, For me, the most insightful thing about wearing this headset had nothing to do with the data I collected. There's a lot of people out there who want to have the evidence. They want to have technical solutions and answers to how they might invest in things in order to get a return on investment. So the idea of this big data could be very appealing to them. But ultimately, people just know that forest bathing is quite good for them. People know that they'd like to go for a walk and they feel good about it. Victorians, when they were putting down trees and making parks, they just intuitively knew without the evidence that actually these were quite nice things for people. And so for me, the headset, you know, you set all the data aside and what that might mean. Actually, from almost like a psychogeographical approach, it almost turned into a radar on my head, which further tuned me in psychologically into the things that I was enjoying, my frustrations of things that may be absent in places. It really highlighted and expanded those emotions in a really interesting way.
Another thing that you've done, which is pretty extraordinary, is that you've been photographed from above walking through different parts of the UK.
Yeah.
And that created into a time-lapse or a speeded-up film. Tell us a little bit about that and the purpose of that.
Yeah, it's interesting listening and, you know, seeing the media and people talking in geographical language, saying things like that the UK is full. And, you know, these are agendas driven forward by particular politicians, particularly parts of the media, who essentially don't like some people. And so they're saying the country is full. And as a geographer who's travelled the UK fairly extensively, who has a geography degree, I came to realise a few years ago that despite the fact I travelled the country a lot and I had a sense of what it was like, I didn't really have a very good sense of proportion of what it was like. Because actually, even if you look at a land use map or a satellite image of the UK from above, it's a pretty big place. And to be honest, I can't even get a good sense of proportion of my own body, really, let alone an entire country. So I decided to go on a journey to see what the UK looked like, because I didn't know for myself, in its correct proportions. And went on a 100-metre walk to make a 100-second film, shot by a drone.
Oh, 100-metre walk.
100-metre walk, 100-second film, where every 1 second of the film, shot from above, and every 1 metre of the walk with me at the centre of the frame, is 1% of what the UK looks like from above. And I did this working in partnership with Friends of the Earth, and we ran a poll through YouGov, and the YouGov poll found that 1 in 3 people in the UK think that over half the country is built on. And what this film shows is
quite
that...
clearly, that's not the case.
Quite clearly, that's not the case. Most people's lived experience distorts their imagination of places, and they think that everywhere else is a bit like where they are. So everyone's on motorways frustrated in Kent, and everyone is like living in these urban sort of high-rise buildings, and that's, you know, your sense of the country. In reality, about 5% of the country is houses and gardens, another couple of percent is other types of built environment. Astonishingly, I think 28% of the UK is grazing for cows and sheep. About 27% of the country is arable land, but half the arable land is for growing crops that are then fed to cows and sheep. And then about another 10% are the moorlands and parts of peat bogs, which are grazed by sheep or maintained for grouse shooting. So at a time when we are in the middle of a climate crisis, an ecological crisis, which is seeing the extinction of, you know, species left, right and centre, and a housing crisis, to make it more controversial, where people are saying there's not enough space for affordable housing, and I know that's a more controversial sort of punctuation to that point, we're completely prioritising, you know, half the country for these ruminant animals, which are essentially harm us and the planet and our ability to survive on the planet. It's absolutely astonishing. And so even if you took 5% of the land away from cows and sheep, that would have an extraordinary impact for wildlife and maybe housing as well. I think that's what this film reveals. But being able to see me as part of the story in centre frame and this aerial shot moving through the countryside gives the viewer, I think, a sense of scale and proportion and narrative that you don't get if you just saw some fairly sterile images of just a camera moving through the landscape. But it was interesting that when we made this film, we got to the end of this sort of 2,000 kilometre journey, and we realised that at the end of the journey we had even less of an idea of what the UK looked like, and we had to get into the editing suite to get that sense of proportion. How powerful would it be if more people were humbled to the idea that they just don't know what the country or the world looks like?
You've been involved in a campaign which you must have been involved in now for, what, six years to bring to fruition, which is London as a national park city. And yet you've had to work bloody hard to get people to even appreciate that designating London as a national park city will drive and encourage more people to explore and manage and encourage more wildlife.
I think it's important to recognise that the London National Park City is standing on the shoulders of over 100 years of there being national parks around the world. So 6 years ago, I started this radical campaign to transform the whole of London into the world's first national park city, which would be a new kind of national park. And rooted in this idea, it really challenges some ways that people think about the relationship between cities and nature and people's relationship with nature. For me, fundamentally, it's about people having a better relationship with nature for their own health and well-being, for the health and well-being of the city, and for wildlife in the city and beyond as well, because cities aren't just the urban footprint, it's everything that the city consumes as well. It's not just about nature. I think that parkour and free running and peregrine falcons hanging out on Tate Modern are just as important as the nature piece, but the nature piece is a really, really significant one. The idea essentially is that just like a desert or a coral reef or a glacier, a city is a habitat, it's a landscape, it's an environment, and just like those other places which we classically think of as national parks, a national park city is a place you can explore, you can contribute, you can improve, it's a vision that you can share, and it's a community of people who are working together to better look after that place and to make it greener, healthier, and wilder. And, you know, for anyone who's finding this hard to get their heads around intellectually, I think there are, from the nature angle, not from the health angle or from the public access angle, but from the nature angle, four reasons why this makes sense. Firstly, urban life is not worth less than rural life. Urban red foxes are just as cool as Arctic foxes and fennec foxes. Homo sapiens that occupied this city, us as animals alongside 15,000 other species that live in London, we are valuable and important just as much so as people in the countryside and orangutans, and we deserve incredible habitats too. That cities are just as exciting, just as accessible, just as interesting to explore as deserts or coral reefs or mountains. They're just different. And finally, you know, there's this idea that nature conservation and making the improvements that are needed are done by expert people in some distant place, often with some exotic species of charismatic wildlife. Whereas actually the vast majority of the world's people live in urban areas. Very soon most people will be living in cities. And the place where these people have most power is the places that they control where they live, on their balconies, in their gardens, and through their purchasing power. So why would you exclude the people who live in the fastest growing habitat around the world, urban environments, from a practice of engaging in nature conservation and improving the habitat they live in? I don't think that any of those things make sense to, you know, push back against those things. So for me, the idea of a national park city is it's an idea that which is time has come. And actually, if the campaign had started 6 years earlier, I don't think it would have moved on as quickly as it has. I mean, you challenge me and say that it hasn't moved quickly. But over 6 years, we've, you know, managed to persuade the Mayor of London, over 1,000 local politicians. I think that in terms of policy and change, we've achieved an extraordinary amount to be able to convince large numbers of people that this very traditional idea that people have very fixed ideas about, this idea of a national park, can actually work for an urban environment as well. The reason why we can do it in London now is because for hundreds of years, Londoners have been enclosing, celebrating, protecting, enjoying, improving green spaces, blue spaces, the city. It's why the city is nearly 50% physically green and blue. It's why we have such an incredible, diverse landscape. And that's come through both top-down policy and through grassroots action, giving us the landscape we have. So the London National Park City is partially about saying, do you know what, by world standards, in terms of our civic society, our institutions, our landscape, this place is really extraordinary. But at the same time, just like rural national parks, where there is poaching and encroachment and various other problems, we also face challenges as well. So the London National Park City is partially about celebrating everything that's been done to make the city as green and wild as it is. So things that make the city truly extraordinary by international standards. But then it's also about acknowledging our shared pains around air pollution, around the housing crisis, around children not playing outside enough, around the decline of many species. But acknowledging that people actually aren't the problem necessarily. They're not a challenge. They're not a barrier to becoming a national park city. They're the opportunity. Because actually, if tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people start doing some fairly simple things, we can not only transform the city's landscape, but also people's lives as well. And this isn't complicated stuff. Often, all these big challenges sound really complicated, and they can be from a policy context. But essentially, if we all walked a bit more, we grew a bit more stuff, and we consumed a little bit differently, like a lot of these problems would evaporate pretty quickly. And so the National Park City is about reframing the urban environment, rethinking what it means to live within this environment, that it's not just a political, cultural, and financial centre, but it's an ecological centre too. And start challenging people to respond to that idea. And for us, there's like a theory of change around this that pinned around two questions. Firstly, a what-if question sets the backdrop of the National Park City, where people go into a dream ideation space, where it's saying, well, what if we had more stand-up paddle boarding on our canals? What if we had more otters in our canals? What if we had more outdoor learning in schools? What if we had less cars in our streets and more space for growing and for play, right? All good what-ifs. But the tipping point comes through the next question, which is why not? Where you start saying, well, why don't we have less cars in our streets taking up all this space when most Londoners don't own cars? Like, why don't we have more outdoor learning in school? Why don't we? I want to see otters in our canals. And actually, you only have to have a few parents going into a school saying, do you know what? All the evidence shows that kids, like, learn better, they're more creative, they're more productive, they're better behaved if they have a great break time. And kids should connect with nature, and as it's not happening through many parents, like maybe schools have a responsibility to make sure that children get that connection. You only have to have a few parents asking that to create these tipping points. And, you know, a good example of that is if you go back a few decades ago, parents would go into a school and say, look, would you mind not hitting my child? And when enough people start asking that question, you get this change. So actually, as Londoners, if enough of us start dreaming, but then start dreaming together, then we can create these tipping points. Now, just like the London National Park City, the reason why we can do it is because actually all the ideas, all the people, all the practices, all the spaces already exist in the city. That's why we can do it. It's about pulling together lots of fragmented things to create something that's more of a whole that brings this together. But it's the result of transposing an idea that's been in the country for 70 years, national parks, an idea that's been successful around the world for much longer, and combining it with that thinking that creates something new. And the last 6 years of campaigning have been on those shoulders. With a national park city, what we're asking for is we're asking for behaviour change. We're asking people, for example, to grow more ivy up their walls, or to learn to love stinging nettles, or to not be afraid of insects, but instead to love holding insects, or to go stand on paddleboarding on a canal intentionally because you know that it'll be really grimy, because that's the start of a conversation to get that canal cleared up so you then get the otters. And with each of these things, yes, it's vital that there are events and people have flags and people make those arguments. And a lot of us are pushing in a really similar direction, even if our tactics or approaches are really quite different. Our theories of change are quite different. But what we want to do within the London National Park City is learn from the best bits of these movements that have brought a lot of people along on their journey. But think about how do we translate the asks into actual actions and in people's everyday lives. And if that's about parents' relationships with their three-year-olds, or about a conflict between whether or not you have a hole in your fence because you quite like hedgehogs, but there's a cat that keeps on coming through and shitting in your back garden, then actually these are very real points of conflict that are about a deeper, longer term. So the way I see it is, for a lot of people, they want to think about how they can do things in their own back gardens. Then things like the London National Park City, not just the London National Park City, but things like the London National Park City are another way to have that conversation.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Dan Raven Ellison. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we'd love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded, and produced by Andrew Stark of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.